the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Hello, this is Athena Melville, your host for Education Now, welcoming you to the July 15th edition, The History of Melville Montessori School. And I'm looking forward to doing this show, and I hope that it will be beneficial to those of you who are listening. Remember, you can contact me anytime during this podcast and through my email at hermes@pacific.net, and you can also send me messages there when you're not listening to a podcast. I don't know if you're listening with me when I cast this, or if you listen to it after the podcast. I'm always available at hermes@pacific.net. Or you can comment on our Facebook page, the Education Now Facebook page. I'm always checking that page during a podcast for the hour or so when we first cast the show, but I check it often. And so if you ever want to connect with me about anything that you hear on the Education Now archive, that's the way to do it, the Facebook page or hermes@pacific.net. Well, let's get started then with the history of Melville Montessori School. I started this school in 1981 with my own four children, who at that time were, 10. I had twin sons, and they were 10, 11. And Anthony was 7. And Christopher, the youngest, was 4, almost 5. And we had come, my ex-husband and I had come to California in 1969 in the fall or late summer, to go to graduate school. Michael was going to go to graduate school. He had a master's in philosophy, and I was going to be working and supporting him while I did some of my own, continued in my own way with my interest in Jungian psychology and play therapy, and while I worked. And so while we were there, of course, huge change taking place in the attitude towards education, because it had been so effective in helping to end the war in Vietnam and to change perspective on civil liberties and civil rights. Now, of course, being in education, and that being the major our major concern, Michael, who had a fellowship, which means they were paying him to go to school, and for that payment, he was also teaching. Both of us were working in Santa Barbara at that time. We were working in Santa Barbara because, having come from the University of Utah, where it's very interesting, in Salt Lake City. Now, I'm not talking about the entire state of Utah, but I am talking about Salt Lake City. At the University of Utah and in Salt Lake City, generally a very cosmopolitan attitude towards education. And if you worked while you were going to school, the community held you in such high regard. And so it was something that I had always done, and something that Michael had done as well, my ex-husband. And so, and then also in being involved in protests, I remember marching in protest against the war in Vietnam, and that there were police there, but they were there, and you very much got the feeling that they were there to protect your right to demonstrate peacefully if you felt that there was some injustice to the body politic. And so it was a very interesting environment to go from that environment to Santa Barbara at a time when the Bank of America was burned down in Isla Vista, which is the small community outside of Santa Barbara. It was burned down because there were so much contribution through that bank to support the war in Vietnam. And so that was the protest that some people were involved in. Now, none of the people who did this action in Isla Vista were students. That I know is true, especially students of the University of California at Santa Barbara. And of course, we lived in married student housing, which meant we were part of the whole lockdown when the Los Angeles Police Department came down to Isla Vista to put Santa Barbara, University of California, Santa Barbara, under martial law. Now, that meant that there were tanks driving around married student housing, and I was pregnant with twin sons. Now, my mother was there to help me out because, you know, she wanted to be part of it, and I was so glad she was there. And we lived right on the outskirts, married student housing, where we lived. But there were other friends who were teaching at the university who lived in Isla Vista, and they were, you know, rocks were coming through the windows, and it was sort of like, oh, you know, better call the police. But wait, they are the police throwing the rocks. And so, you know, people would gather at our little apartment because it was there on the outskirts. And during that time, it became so apparent to me that a totally different attitude of police force in Salt Lake City and police force in Isla Vista to protest or, you know, speaking out at injustice. Now, I do not know, I mean, I was pregnant and I left it at that with notes. Well, having left it at that with notes, I find that this is the time to come back to those memories, because it seems crucial to me that when we look at human services, in education, but also in like police force, when those human services are stripped of the personal and the interactive, they contradict the term human. And they're run like businesses where people become objects and are robbed of their uniqueness. Well, this is what my gut told me when I was in college studying speech pathology. And I was told that I would have problems because I was too emotionally involved with the children. And so, when I found Montessori, you might say I found an advocate for what I just found to be intuitively true. Now, I found Montessori when it became apparent that if Proposition 13 passed, there were going to be such an upheaval in education in California, which was like the crown in the jewel of California, was its education system, and the compromises that have been made so that we find it in the state it is today. Not that there aren't pockets of just where, you know, against all odds, teachers have done amazing things and whole communities like in Palo Alto that chose not to let their schools be affected by the way the taxes and the property taxes were dealt with at that time. So knowing that this was going to be coming around the corner, I went from not just having my children in Montessori schools, but doing some training with Joy Turner, and depending on what we decided to do in terms of how the university and the college was changing and whether or not Michael felt he could continue to work in that system, I wanted to be prepared. And so when the decision was made that we were going to be moving up to here to Mendocino County, and Michael was going to be working with through Mendocino College with the Native American community and philosophy, and I thought that was great, and I would be homeschooling. And so that was how it all happened in 1981. Well, it's a long story about what happened with Michael and working with the Native American community through Mendocino College. It never really materialized. The funds were always taken away when it came to that area. And so when people approached me about bringing students into my home to go to expand my homeschool, it meant putting aside writing, which I was also very much enjoying doing, and responding in a way that was something that other people wanted, and so I wanted to do it too. So to back up a little bit, after my twin sons were born, John and Nico, I started to study Montessori methods and to read Jung and Freud. Later, I started taking classes in play therapy through the Jung Institute in Los Angeles, creative writing workshops, and other seminars through the Jung Club. And then I started running a summer arts program in my home. My boys attended Montessori schools, and by the time my third son, Tony, was ready for school, I started working in the classroom. I also attended a national workshop called Fantasy and Creativity in the Life of the Child with people like Bruno Bettelheim and Marilyn Ferguson. The group of teachers was split in two camps at that particular conference, those who followed Bruno Bettelheim and supported his view that yes, the kids should play with war toys because they go through the whole history of evolution in their play, and if they don't act these things out in play, they will be repressed, and he would always use Germany as an example. Bettelheim had personal experience in Nazi Germany. Other teachers were saying no war toys. Now for me, this was really an insightful time. I was on Bruno Bettelheim's side and still believe it is important for children to act out through play, fantasy, and myth. And that is one of the things I love so much about fantasy war play or fanwar, which Christopher Melville, my youngest son, who is a Montessori teacher, has really developed into a wonderful experience. You can find them on the web at fanwar.com. Well, anyway, now in 81, when we moved here to Willits, or to Mendocino County, I'm not in Willits now, we founded this Montessori-based education, and from my home school, it grew. And its philosophy comes from my own experience And I have been its principal since the beginning. And although I do not have a teaching credential, due to the success of the school and the children who came out of it, over the years I've mentored student teachers from Dominican College and Sonoma State University and MCOE here in Mendocino County. My son Anthony and I, it was about 3 years, Anthony, who has a degree in music education from Sonoma State, he was principal for the school for a time and was a full-time teacher. Anthony is now a full-time Montessori teacher at Tree of Life School, a Tree of Life Montessori Charter School, and so is Christopher, full-time teacher at Tree of Life Montessori Charter School here in Ukiah. And Anthony also is running a program he calls Muse, along with Sarah Esserman Melville, and it's a music and tutoring service. And they're doing summer camp, summer arts this summer, and they did a rock camp. And so it's wonderful to see that the ideas that got their birth at Melville Montessori School continue to thrive in other areas. Well, I want to get back now. We've talked a little bit about what gave birth to the school, and a little bit about some of the things that grew out of the school, some of the births that Montessori School helped create or helped found. But now I want to talk about the actual process of the school. And aside from, I feel that I've told you why I feel it was essential that I do this at the time. I could not have afforded to send my children to a private school, although I think I would have done that so that they would have had more interaction. But I also really enjoyed the process of being the teacher for my own children. And I feel that they are all great teachers themselves, and so are my granddaughters. It's wonderful to have grandchildren as well. Well, one of the basic things that we did at Melville Montessori School was, when a family joined us, we looked at it that way, that we were taking the family, we weren't just taking the child. And so it was always offered to the parent that they could have a reduction in tuition if they somehow participated in the process, whether it was that they chose to share their passion with the rest of the students for a particular subject, or whether they came and did things at the school, or whether they provided some kind of service for our family or for another student at the school. And so that was really wonderful too, because then the students saw all of their parents empowered. And so, as well as empowering one another by teaching each other which students do in a Montessori environment, parents were also empowered. And I learned so much from those parents and, of course, from those students. I have some great stories and great memories from the things that students have taught me and that parents have taught me. Parents have taught every subject: dance, art, double digging, gardening, how to make incredible things out of the natural things we can find in the environment, leaching acorns, sweat lodges, creating pools to grow fish, that then growing plants that clean the water once you got it, take it out of from the fish tank, and then feeding that clean water after the plants have cleaned it back to the fish, and then using the water from the fish to fertilize the plants, and running it all on a bicycle that that one of our students, Ralph Hine, hooked up to a the motor of a discarded washing machine, and we would generate energy to move the water by riding the bicycle, therefore getting exercise. Wonderfully creative projects. And then if a student, and many of them did, surpass what we could offer them, they would go to Mendocino College to fulfill a requirement, and especially a second language. That was very important to me, and we never managed to really get someone consistently doing a second language for the students in this area, and so that was crucial. And for my humanities students, those who were going to be graduating, I needed really to have to be able to let them go just as far as they could in English and math and music, in science, in the sciences. And so I just could not be more grateful that Mendocino College was there for that purpose. And then, of course, our parents were amazing people, and almost all of them had graduated college. And so they had so much to offer, as well as having come to this area to be more self-sustaining themselves, so that they could offer that knowledge to the students who use the school. And so it was a beautiful relationship. And then we would have, I would think that some features that we had that were very unique to our school was a very emphasis on mythology and knowing your own roots and who you were at that very deepest level. And so rather than saying, we did see that there was a separation between church and state, in that there wasn't the state religion that was going to be taught at the school, but that everyone's own traditions would be valued and shared with one another. All of that would not be lost. It would be shared and developed. And so the mythology became so crucial to this, and also to developing the self-concept necessary to really excel in the world and to really stand on your own, as well as being a member of a community. So that was our emphasis. And so I can't tell you again, I want to say that without really all of the parents and all of the students, that is what made it work so well. And of course, there were those foundational parents and members who gave much beyond the call. And we never had a focus on any kind of like, oh, we were all Democrats or Republicans. It was not like that. As a matter of fact, we would not even allow for political signs or statements in the yard of the school, because we felt that, that it was so important. Just like we would not have a particular religious symbol on the school, all of them would be there if any of them were there. That was the goal, to be totally inclusive. Now, philosophically, we would have, as well as the children developing their own identity and knowing who they were, that was part of the philosophy, was knowing who you were. There was a lot of dialogue, and then we would have In order to develop what Montessori felt was so important was public speaking. And so as well as competing then later in public speaking and also in what's called mock trial here in our area, our students participated in that, and we had a judge and a lawyer from the community who were our mentors and came in and helped us develop our skills. And I can't tell you how well the students performed. As a matter of fact, they performed so well the first year, and then the second year they performed equally well. And the reason that was used that our students could no longer participate was because some of them were too young. They were only 13. And I was just, I told the students, do not feel bad about this snub. After all, you're being told that you're just too smart at too young of an age to be able to compete. But, and they did, and the students did also exceptionally well in public speaking when the community, like the Lions Club, would offer up a topic and students would compete. They did extraordinarily well. So that was wonderful, but all of them really needed to participate. And in order to develop this, we would have, you would present your research paper, you would present it to the rest of the class as a presentation. It wasn't just something that you wrote up. And also you would do an oral on your own history, your own personal history. So it could be on you personally, it could be on a relative, it could be on a sibling. And so the children got a lot of opportunity to stand up and speak, as well as in the circle, which traditional Montessori school will have a circle, an informational circle, as well as a sharing circle. We would also do performances twice a year. Usually in the winter, we would do a performance that was for family and friends. And always our refreshments, I think, were outstanding, as well as the fare that was offered in terms of performance. The students always did just such amazing work, and I enjoyed so much facilitating for a long while drama, and then also for chorus. But I found more and more people coming who I felt could do more with chorus, and always great bands. And then in the spring, at the end of the year, we would do a performance for the public. And students knew that I felt that if you were asking for money, if you were asking people to pay and come and see a performance, it had to be professional quality. And so the students worked not only on their performing and their dance skills, but also lights and costumes, sound, refreshments, set. They worked every feature of a production, and it was just fantastic. One year, the students wanted to make a movie. This was in the very beginnings of Bugsy Malone, the children's version. And I have to tell you that one of the most amazing parents I've ever worked with was Jane Shattuck, just an amazing woman who had run in a nursery in her own home for a long while. Just amazing in her dance, videography, photography, art. What an amazing human being. And so Jane helped do this movie, and the children were so delighted that they could actually do this movie. And it was just wonderful. It was just a wonderful experience. And we used the community, really. The community was so open. The ice cream shop the judge's offices, the outside of the library. It was just a wonderful experience, and a parent actually built one of the Bugsy cars, you know, with the pedals, but fashioned after the 20s. It was just, oh, I just can't tell you what a wonderful experience it was. And we moved from actually adapting scripts then from movies or books that students loved or classics to actually writing our own script. And one year we did one called Time Travelers. And it was especially because students were all feeling such pain from the environmental devastation and that they were seeing. And it wasn't that they were shielded from the truth and the facts. I would say that our students knew about global warming for a very long time. And there had to be expression. And so they would resolve these problems in their plays and in their dances that they would choreograph. And this was another amazing thing. As the students were there longer, some of them, and then they would graduate, they would become teachers. And I would pay once a student was teaching a subject with full responsibility, they were paid minimum wage for that work. I think I paid beyond minimum wage. I think we paid $10 an hour. But they'll have to tell me if I'm wrong about that. And that was such a delight for me, because this was a dream that Montessori had, and it was just developed to its fullest at our school. They would teach art classes, photography, dance classes, drama classes, band. Anthony just developed so many wonderful bands. And then for a time, he had what was called rock concerts in the park. And he would encourage bands from all the entire community to come and perform on the stage in Willits. And for the entire day, there would be people having picnics and dancing and listening to the performers. And there would be concessions. It was just a wonderful way for people to get together and express themselves in constructive ways. So those were some of the successes of the school that I'm very proud of. Now, of course, we believed that school was an extension of the family and not a business, and that was crucial. And we really were oriented towards empowering parents, because the notion that the children belong to the state is disgusting, and it always will be. Now let's get back to testing and labels. Well, we don't use textbooks at the school. We didn't use textbooks because information was constantly changing, and with the computers, you know, it was just wonderful, and it should be even better now. And I'm very grateful to Jeff Smith, who really did so much to get a thriving computer programming going at the school early on. And the children were all very proficient with the computer, surpassed my skills. But we found it much more valuable to teach children how to get information, and just let learning come to life. And I'm also very grateful to Sally Smith, who developed a huge video library, because every time she would say to me, "So what are they interested in?" And I would, you know, I would ask each student, you know, "Well, what are you interested in?" so that I could help them find information. And I would share with Sally, and she would just get videos. Yeah, it was just outstanding. I can't thank her enough. And we also found in the research that the best indicator of how a person will do in college and how they'll do in life is a teacher recommendation. Even though, as I've said many times in other broadcasts and podcasts, that's supposed to be very subjective, because a teacher is supposed to have a prejudice. Yet it still is the best indicator. And really, standardized tests are gender-based, like the SATs. So that means that they're good for their state, but they're not good for the child. And if you give children concrete experiences of math and language, and boys and girls will end up understanding abstractions and metaphor at about the same age and with equal ease. And if you don't understand what I'm talking about, you know, you're not supposed to talk about gender differences. But depending on how you present material, you work on there, because there are some gender-based differences. If when you don't present things in a concrete way, boys will tend to lag in English and or language, and girls will tend to lag in math. And so let's leave that discussion for when we talk about brain research, but it's there. And labels are very damaging to self-concepts. So when a student would come to me with a brand from a public school, didn't want to hear it. I didn't even read the stuff. And I just considered the whole child and did my own assessment to help the child learn at their own pace. I also think that the learning there was very organic and with lots of expression. The majority of boys like movement. We know that because they, you know, how many times you hear teachers say the boy who can't sit still, but girls really love it too. Even though they're very good at, you know, if you tell a girl or most girls to please sit still, they will. It's really not good for them. Well, you know, I mean, it's not good to them if it's to the point where they will prevent themselves from going to the bathroom just because someone says they shouldn't. And movement is so important to learning. That's another thing that you can find out about if you check the current brain research, just how important learning is, movement is to learning. And, you know, when we would have circle, you'd have a kindergartner there sitting with a senior in high school, and you'd think, oh, gee, they can't really, but they listen to each other. They communicate. It's just amazing and so wonderfully fun. There's also something that Montessori talks about, this beautiful time when you can experience the children just being silent spontaneously. And it's hard to experience, but because we tend so much to say, shh, be quiet, when it gets to that certain noise level. But if you let it get there, all of a sudden, it'll just stop. The noise level becomes this silence. And that's when absorption begins. And it's also pretty miraculous if you notice it. We also believed in integrating the curriculum. So we would start the day in one room in a large circle on the rug. And during work periods, the children would work by themselves with one or other person in a small group. But they were never discouraged from choosing what they wanted to do. No one was saying, oh, but now it's time to do math. Now, there may have been an agreement that you had with an individual student that you had worked out together, but it wasn't like a work period was very much a time when a person was choosing what they wanted to do. It's my personal view that Montessori education is a combination of developmental and behavioral theory. The early 20th century theories of childhood and growth development really fell into two camps. The developmentalists, who believed that everything depended on what a child inherited at birth, and the behavioralists, which believed that children were born as empty vessels and they come into this world and we fill them up like a container of water. Maria Montessori, I think, saw through this dualism and felt that children developed through the interaction of their inner being with the environment. A child never failed in a Montessori environment. Things are arranged so the student can always figure out a way to achieve success without appealing to authority. Now, it's different when a child gets into adolescence. Then I think the environment allows for failure because you learn so much through failure, but not at the young age. I feel that Montessori would agree with John Dewey, who felt that children should, that you should allow children to experience failure in their adolescence. She didn't really address that, you know, in detail. Now, to our school, the contributions of depth psychologist Carl Jung are as major as Montessori. Jung knew that art, in all of its forms, serves to release repressed feelings, and that great art opens a window to the future. And I feel that Aristotle probably thought that too. Now, one year when I was preparing for my history mythology classes and we were studying indigenous culture, I could find all these rich examples of indigenous culture in North America, in South America, in Australia, in Africa, in Eastern Europe, and, you know, on the islands, but not much in Europe, in the northern part of Europe. And then I happened to watch an incredible special called The Burning Times, and I realized that for many generations, Northern and Western European children had watched their mothers burn. And this helped me. This really helped me not only understand why indigenous culture is scarce in Western and Northern Europe, but also why Jung was such an important phenomenon for our time. And I just want to ask you what that loss of an indigenous view, and look at what we are doing to the earth right now and who is in control. And how anyone could deny that repression and denial are not at work yet again. Well, at our school, the use of ritual and celebration in exploring who we are is also inspired by Jung. And during the school year, our mythology psychology corps allowed kids to explore their heritage. And if that included Judaism and also Catholicism, that child would study the myths and the traditions to find out their own roots, and also resolved any of those, you know, hidden, insidious fears and hatred of the other. Maria Montessori felt that her methods belonged to the world and not to individuals or institutions. At the Panama Pacific International Exhibition in San Francisco in 1915, she was asked to set up a glass classroom so people could observe self-directed children. She asked her friend Helen Parkhurst to be the teacher in this environment. And although Helen Parkhurst had left Montessori to start her own system, Maria wanted Helen. She was open that way. To use the Montessori name, you don't have to belong to any organization, although I feel that the American Montessori Society is very beneficial, especially in these times. But it's not necessary to use her name. Jung felt this way also, and he once commented that he was glad he was Jung and not a Jungian. And I feel that Montessori would feel the same way. When people take the work and words of people like Jung and Montessori, who invested so much in keeping the individual alive, and turn them into dogma, it contradicts the spirit of freedom and education that they represented. Montessori was born in 1890, and she died in 1952. Several individuals who made contributions to education and child psychology studied under her, including Anna Freud and Jean Piaget, Alfred Adler, and Erik Erikson. Many elements of modern education were adapted from her theories: individualized education, the knowledge of different ways and styles of learning, the open classroom, programmed instruction, manipulative learning materials, teaching toys, and child-sized furniture. Her great vision was of a cosmic education, where although you begin to study a part, you always see that part's connection to the whole. Our school used her name to acknowledge and tell her spirit, that some of us do remember, because she's gotten such short shrift in the educational community at large and so little recognition. A Montessori teacher, in my opinion, or any good teacher, and I feel that parents are the first real teachers, passes the love of learning to their students or to their children in an environment where they can be self-directed. The ideal of becoming self-sufficient and responsible humans, I feel, is reflected in the quote from Maria Montessori when she says, "My vision of the future is no longer of people taking exams and proceeding on the certification from the secondary school to the university, but of individuals passing from one stage of independence to a higher by means of their own activity, through their own effort of will, which constitutes the inner evolution of the individual." Now, I feel that a lot of what we did at Montessori School, at Melville Montessori School, was reflecting the theory of chaos and complexity, which tells us that a small change can affect the whole. or the 100th monkey, so to speak. So by valuing self-direction, good character, respect for nature and each other, our school embraced that awareness. We believed that we made a difference. Einstein tells us that 2% of positive energy can affect the whole system. We don't need a majority to shift the balance in the attitudes and actions of the people on the earth. Knowing that the critical minority is 2% gave us great hope. In human terms, denial and apathy are the greatest obstacles to the growth of human consciousness. Well, there you have our philosophy and some of what we did. Our students also, in 1995, were invited by Joy Turner and the American Montessori Society to the 1995 Fall Regional Seminar, which was held October 27th through the 29th at the Miramar Sheridan Hotel in Santa Monica, California, to deliver a workshop on creativity. And as it happened, Christopher Melville, the developer of Fantasy Warplay, or Fanwar, who I told you is a graduate of Montessori School, and my youngest son, had delivered a speech called Today's Youth, Why the Violence, and he'd won a scholarship for that speech, although he won much of he went much further with a speech he wrote called Today's Media, the Media, have they gone too far? And which is also a great speech. But so AMS and Joy invited him to do this workshop and to deliver his speech, at which he did. And then he and two other graduates, Anthony Melville and Damara Ganley, illustrated for the workshop ways in which to integrate arts into the curriculum, drama, which Montessori loved drama, and just more ways of integrating drama, movement, fantasy, art into the curriculum. Well, I feel that I've offered you a good idea of the history of Melville Montessori School. And if you have any questions, I certainly hope that you will contact me at hermes@pacific.net or through our Facebook page. You can find News of Education Now podcasts by visiting the American Montessori website at www.amshq.org and looking in the events calendar. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. An archive of all broadcasts can be heard with free download at the website. This is Athena Melville, and I'm sending cosmic love to you all.
You are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked.